Hi there. This is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the N. Savvides podcast. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working well with filmmakers, musicians, and other creative people to do great imaginative things. And sometimes we talk about trying to make the world better in some way. Now, this episode is something special. It's a new first for the N. Savvides podcast. I bring you an interview with a distributor, a well-regarded distributor, Bond360. Now, this is pretty neat because a lot of times distributors are busy buying films, going to these different festivals. They're not the ones always doing interviews, but they're usually the ones that help make a filmmaker's career viable. They're buying films, helping filmmakers survive. That's an admirable cause, right? So we're talking to Elizabeth Sheldon. She's the chief operating officer of Bond 360. Bond 360 is a distribution company that grew out of Bond Strategy and Influence, which provides marketing for film campaigns. And they've worked on some big ones, including the Oscar-nominated Exit Through the Gift Shop, The Imposter, Particle Fever. The films they've worked on have received recognition at Sundance, Toronto, Hot Docs, New York Times, Critics Picks, and so on. In this episode, I talked to Elizabeth about her work at Bond 360, how she likes to collaborate with filmmakers, what she looks for when she goes to film festivals, and then towards the end, we even look at some of the recent films and the specific marketing choices they made to promote those films. Plus, Elizabeth shares some breaking news about a development that came out of South by Southwest 2017. If you make it all the way to the end, you'll get to hear my take on one of their films, God Knows Where I Am. In discussing it, the faith-science dichotomy comes up, as do a couple of other things. All that and more coming up in our interview with Elizabeth. Stick around. This is the N. Savvides podcast. Hello, hello, hello. Elizabeth Sheldon, welcome to the N. Savvides podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You've been with Bond 360 as their chief operating officer since 2016. What got you interested in working for the company?
I had always been aware of Bond, mainly because I would often compete with them for the same films for distribution. So I knew they had excellent taste. I also admired Mark Schiller, the founder of the company. He was a dynamic entrepreneur who really clearly had a love of filmmakers and of film, and that's something that we both shared. When I was asked to join the company at the beginning of 2016, I thought it was a great opportunity for me to build on his legacy and to engage with filmmakers in a direct venue by working with them on all rights distribution in the US, Canada, and in some cases, even worldwide.
Bond 360 started as a marketing company and then it expanded into distribution. That's not something that all of the companies do, right? But that seems like that would give you an edge in the distribution field.
We like to think so. I think having the marketing background has allowed us to understand that what we bring to the table when we work with filmmakers is a knowledge of the marketplace that allows us to position their films, to tap into their audience, and to build awareness around their film beyond what they have done already through the grassroots outreach or the fundraising to amplify their film's potential.
Yeah, it makes sense. It seems like it's a smart positioning for you all and your filmmaking partners.
The world of film is always changing, and how you market films and how you reach audiences. With every film, it's a new challenge. There is no special sauce that applies to every single film. I think one of the things I really love about the business is that every film represents a new opportunity and a new challenge.
Your name shows up as the person who negotiates the deals for the films you'll acquire. What are some of the other responsibilities you have as the chief operating officer?
We're a scrappy boutique distributor. So everybody on the team wears mini hats. I take the lead for the acquisitions, for the selection of the films, the negotiating with the filmmakers, and the formulation of the release plan, and then work very closely with my team to execute from the plan from the pre-theatrical on down to the home video DVD. We make sure that every landmark is publicized in order to build on each successive wave of a film's release.
So how granular do you get with the campaign? Are you approving all the posters and the trailers and the social media campaigns, or is that spread out with your team?
We work collectively. So there's no, I would say that I like to see everything before it goes out. I have many, many years of experience doing this. And so I've learned from my mistakes in the past, and I like to make sure that they aren't repeated. So I work very closely with all of my colleagues, be it on the poster or the trailer. I give a lot of creative leeway, but when it comes down to the minute details, perhaps I'm a little too hands-on. Maybe that'll change in the near future.
Well, you mentioned your vast experience and learning from some of your mistakes. Would you care to elaborate on?
Not on the mistakes. No.
Okay, fair enough. Maybe not mistakes you've made, but you've seen others in handling other films.
The example that comes to mind when you asked about the posters was when we sent them out to be printed and there were no quotes. You always want to, in my opinion, you always want to have quotes on a poster, because any film that's had any exposure via, you know, with a festival or hopefully with the New York Times or the Village Voice, you should have a quote. And audiences love to think that they are watching something that the critics think highly of. So that's something that I've learned along the way. That's a small example, of course. I'll refrain from sharing any of the larger failures. I always
fair enough. When you're getting quotes, is it always a critic, or could it be someone who's an influencer in that particular subject?
It depends on the film. We released one film recently called An Art That Nature Makes, a film about the photographer Rosamund Purcell, and Errol Morris loves her work. So of course we use the Errol Morris quote. That carried a lot of weight with Rosamond, the subject of the film, but also with a lot of film buffs, of course. I think, though, for other films, if you were reaching out to a larger public audience and you need to establish why they should pay $15 in a crowded marketplace to go see a film, it never hurts to have a rave review from A.O. Scott or Manola Dargis.
Right. So do you all cultivate special relationships with some of those guys?
Of course. And that's where the publicists come in place. So one thing that Bond builds for every film release is a bespoke team. So what we do the marketing and the trailers and the posters and the social media. We also bring in-house on as part of the team, depending on which film, publicists or grassroots, I guess you would call them advocates, et cetera, depending on the film. So we're very flexible. And for each film, we develop a unique strategy.
All right. So what are some of the things that you all are looking for in the films you consider? You all seem to focus primarily on documentaries. Is that something that you're flexible on? Is it always going to be documentaries?
What's the vision? I love documentaries. It certainly is in our DNA, and that's where we've gotten started. We would like to expand into narrative films. Narrative films are challenging for independent distributors, mainly because it is a different marketing challenge, and you have to be cognizant of that before you take on the responsibility of promising somebody 100 theatrical markets for their indie film. I think that there are also different elements that you consider with narrative films. It's certainly easier to release a narrative film that has a star attached to it. A lot of our friendly competitors release narrative films that are largely foreign. I think that brings also a different set of challenges with it. And I think that with the documentaries, we have a lot of experience and understand how to effectively release them and to reach the audience. We would like to broaden our mandate so that we also include narrative films, but we have to find the right film.
And it seems like a number of your films also have a socially conscious aspect, or they are making astute social commentary. Is that also a factor, or that just happened to be the case in the lineup recently?
I think that the number one criterion at Bond for acquiring a film is the artistic merit. If we have acquired films that have a social impact, social conscious element to them, that is almost secondary. And it's certainly not the main objective of the film. So these are films where the filmmakers first and foremost want to tell a story. And they want that story to be as compelling as they can make it. Recent examples would include Karl Marx City, which is about the filmmaker's father who committed suicide in East Germany. And she asked the question, why? Suicide touches the lives of many people, but this film, of course, transcends that personal question because it's also a return to her home, which was Karl Marx City in East Germany, where she grew up. And so we have the opportunity as an American audience to understand the mechanism of a police state. And that becomes a much larger question, especially in today's political situation, of how people function in societies in which individual freedom is so curtailed, and what is that legacy? Another film that we've recently released is God Knows Where I Am, which is the story of Linda Bishop, a woman who inadvertently starved herself to death in a farmhouse in New Hampshire. She suffered from bipolar mental illness, and when she refused treatment, was released from the hospital. She had family, she had a daughter, and she had a sister, neither of whom was informed of her release due to her civil liberties, which the state upholds in regards to mentally ill people and their right to privacy. And so she walked out of the hospital on a fairly warm fall afternoon, found an abandoned farmhouse, and of course, slipped into a state where she could no longer make choices that would preserve her life. And so she starved to death over a period of about 50 days when she ran out of rainwater and apples. Of course, there's a social policy element to that film, but the main story of the film, it's not a lecture on civil liberties and the mental health system in the United States, but it's the tragedy of one woman who fell through the proverbial cracks in our system. It's also a cinematic masterpiece. That's what the critics say, not me.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned those two films. We'll come back to them here in a moment. But I imagine that you are getting a whole lot of filmmakers sending work your way. How do you qualify the films that you even consider? Do you want to get a recommendation from others you trust? Do you want to see festival traction? What kinds of things make it manageable so you're not trying to review the hundreds or possibly thousands of films that get sent your way?
We actually do review almost everything that gets sent our way. And I found myself in the position yesterday of having watched possibly the worst film that I have ever seen in my life.
Okay.
Having to respond to the filmmaker. And I was blunt. I think sometimes honesty is the best.
So you said more or less that this was possibly the worst thing I've ever seen?
No, I didn't say that. But I did explain to him that even if he were to pay us, we are full up at the moment. Generally, right. And that's definitely the exception to the rule. So, you know, most films that get to a stage where they're being presented to a distributor have either been through, you know, have come to my attention through a festival. I rely heavily on festivals. Agents, of course, we love to work closely with them. They really have their you know, their fingers on the pulse of the filmmaking community. But I also like working directly with filmmakers. And we're open to looking at different types of films. Not every film is in need of a 50-city national theatrical release and qualifying for an Oscar. There are many, many excellent films out there where the primary target would be museum screenings or educational sales. Bond Educator is a division of the company that I founded in 2016, and it's become a very robust part of our release strategy, where we are selling to colleges, universities, and nonprofits our films with the right, with public performance rights. And we're finding that there's a real demand on college campuses and public libraries for our films because they do engage audiences with larger issues today, and they're not pure entertainment.
Is that a way that filmmakers can actually make some money, or you all think of it more of as a way to build awareness for the film, for the broader release?
It's not an either or question. It's both. So we really look for films and will acquire films that we think will be strong performers to the college, university, market, libraries. It is profitable, and it also does raise awareness of the film and the issues that it engages with. So it's probably one of the best paths that we have to release many of our films. And it will either be in addition to, or it will be the primary venue up until the time that it goes on iTunes or a digital sale or television or DVD.
Going back to the film that you said was one of the worst things that you've seen in a very long time, the way that film came to you, is that something that you still want to be open to those kinds of submissions? Or do you want to say, well, this was an unfortunate experience, I want to limit these kinds of films coming in? And if so, how would you adjust?
I would never want to lose out on that perverse experience of watching a truly horrible film. It really makes you appreciate the good ones, perhaps even the average ones. And there's a certain place, I think, for this was a first-time film. I believe the gentleman has gone on and has made several others. I'm sure he learned much from that first film. And it's always refreshing to see where people start and hopefully where they go. So I'm not looking to say, let's turn off that pipeline, because it's a process for everybody. And I didn't invest in the whole entire film. I didn't watch it to the bitter end.
Okay. So you gave it like 20 minutes, 30 minutes or whatever. And then you said, clearly this is not for us.
When something's bad, it's usually, if it doesn't improve in the first 5 minutes, it's not going to.
Okay.
And remember that the audience, they also are, I mean, how spoiled are all of us? We are used to turning on Netflix or POV or whatever might be your choice and having really world-class entertainment at our fingertips. And if it doesn't satisfy, we just click the button and move on. So I always keep that in mind when I'm watching a film. I assume that the audience we cater to has they have both a longer attention span, but they also have higher expectations. And so you have to meet both of those.
So is that your threshold around 5 minutes, 10 minutes? And then if it doesn't connect at that point, that's it?
Yes.
Okay. We met at South by Southwest this year. And you are someone who attends a lot of festivals. Walk us through what your festival experience is like and how filmmakers there at any given festival can connect with you.
You'd send me an email. I get lots of emails, and I like to think that I respond to most of them. When you go to a festival, you have at least 50, if not hundreds of films that are being presented to buyers. And it's always good, you know, I sit down beforehand and my team and I, we do our homework and we go through. But then I also look for people to point things out to me. And so the filmmakers are always free to reach out to me and to say, you know, my film X is premiering at South by Southwest. I also rely on agents. I have to say that, you know, they will frequently solicit my attention because they know what I'm looking to buy and tell me what they think might work. And then there's cocktail chatter. I've picked up many, many films on the recommendations of people whose opinions I trust and who know the type of film that Bond is looking for.
So you'll go and hang out at one of the bars at a festival like South By and say, hey, what have you seen? What's connecting with you? That kind of thing.
Absolutely. The industry cocktail is always worth time invested there.
Yeah, especially if you get a few drinks into people and then they tell you what they really think, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Now, we're at the part of the show where Elizabeth is about to share a new development from South by Southwest. Before we get to that, I want to tell you a little bit about some of the things I'm working on when I'm not doing the show. Some of you know I do some film and video projects on the side, and I've recently put together an updated video portfolio site. You can see some of the videos I've done that I'm most proud of doing, and it's there on my site. Look for it under the videos heading right near the top. As I mentioned in last episode, June is PTSD Awareness Month. And so for the first time ever, we are publicly sharing the short film I directed about a soldier battling PTSD. It's called Trench War. We haven't shared it for a while for a couple of reasons. I won't bore you with that here, but it's something that's close to my heart. We worked hard on, and it's something that we want to tell that story about the struggles that people can face sometimes when exposed to traumatic things and what it looks like trying to get their lives back together. If you go to the videos page, you'll see it there. It's the first video on that little site. Or you can go to it directly. It's video.ncevides.com. Either way, I'd appreciate it if you check it out. And if you see it or some of the other videos on there and you connect in some way, why not leave a comment? It's podcast@ncevides.com. Once again, podcast@ncevides.com. That really is a great way to encourage me to keep putting out these podcast episodes for you. All right, now let's get back to our interview with Elizabeth Sheldon. Did you all find any films from South By?
Yes, and we've just concluded negotiations, so I'll break the news here. We're very pleased that we've just picked up Through the Repellent Fence, which is a Land Art film that was shown. I went to see it when I was at South by Southwest and really found it an engaging film because it's both about an installation that will never happen again. It also, though, addresses the issue of the Mexican-U.S. border through art. And it's also done by a group of artists who are emerging, certainly, and becoming quite well respected for the work that they do. The film has also been shown here at MoMA. And so we're very excited. I think the second category of films that we really excel at releasing is art documentaries. Uh-huh. We've just released Maurizio Cattelan, Be Right Back. One of our Bond's first releases was Yarn, which was also a South by Southwest premiere in 2016, and then an Art That Nature Makes. So art docs are in our wheelhouse, and we actively look to acquire them.
And that film, was it something that was on your radar before South by Southwest, or you discovered it there?
I discovered it there, and I got to meet the filmmaker and the producer, and I really enjoyed the conversation that we had. First and foremost, I really enjoyed seeing the film, and it's a good match between both of us. Filmmakers can have expectations, and I think it's very important in order to have a successful relationship that the filmmaker expectations and the distributor's promises for what they can deliver match.
All right. Well, along those lines of filmmaker contributions and expectations, I read an article from Kobe Shelley that said 50% of filmmaking is making the film, 50% is selling the film. Do you agree? Is it that much of an involvement from the filmmakers to help get it to market?
Yes. You know, if you have a film that you've made and you don't successfully release it, it's like writing a book that never gets published. The publishers are necessary because they are curating. They have an audience that turns to them for a certain type of, in our case, film. And a good partnership can mean that both parties amplify their success. So nobody wants to write a book and then have the manuscript just sit on their shelf. Fortunately, filmmakers tend to be an extremely outgoing bunch. And so they make their films and then they hit the festival circuit. And, you know, sometimes they stay on that festival circuit a little too long. But the distributors, you know, it's a good marriage because we need filmmakers and our job is to make sure that their work pays off for them. And that can take different forms. It can take, you know, it can be monetary. It can be raising the film's profile. It can be qualifying it for an Oscar. It can be establishing them as auteurs in their own right, who will grow and hopefully come back, you know, film after film, so that we have a relationship that grows.
You mentioned some filmmakers are on the festival circuit too long. How long is too long?
I had a wonderful film that I picked up once, and I think that the filmmaker had been to every single festival in North America.
Okay.
And then he asked the company I was with at the time to release it theatrically, and we did, but it was extremely challenging because although the film was it was a critic's darling and it was an excellent film, it was on the subject of post-traumatic stress disorder, which, you know, not everybody wants to go see that with their date on Saturday night.
Sure.
And probably most of the people who do want to see that film went to the local film festival. And so I always advise caution in regards to overexposure on the festival market, unless you are comfortable saying that's going to be my theatrical release, essentially. And that's a valid thing to do because it is a way to get audiences to see your film, to get laurels, and not to incur the expense of a bona fide theatrical. So it's understanding the choices in the marketplace.
What are some other misunderstandings that filmmakers have about film acquisitions and distribution?
I think there's been a bit of a change over the last couple of years. I think there was a period where there was a real industry sense that distributors somehow took a lot and didn't give much in return. And that, you know, perhaps doing it yourself, the DIY model, was a better way. I always thought that what filmmakers didn't understand was the hidden cost of marketing the film, building the film's website, trying to monetize the film. Distributors bring partners and partners to the table. We have distribution channels, so we are able to take that film, invest in that film, and then turn around and say to our partners, whether it's Netflix or whether it's Amazon or TCM or Stars, this is a film that has played in 35 markets, or this is a film that Manola Dargis said it's a masterpiece. And in doing so, we create value with other buyers. And then those buyers, of course, enter in as partners. It's very difficult to do that as a filmmaker on your own. You don't have a library and you don't have the content where larger partners who have defined audiences will take the time to do business with you.
Right. So it's almost like they are taking advantage of your relationships with these bigger entities.
Yes. And these bigger entities look to us as curators to bring them the best. And so when we acquire a film, we're saying that we're going to take this film, we're going to invest in this film, and we're going to elevate the profile of this film so that our partners will say, oh, yes, you know, that's something that we'd like to pick up for broadcast.
What are some of the best practices that filmmakers can do to work with a distributor like Bond 360?
Alignment of expectations is very important. Understanding that our interest and the filmmaker's interests are usually one and the same, and trusting in our judgment. We have a lot of experience, and we are always tapping into that experience in order to build and do what's best for a film.
And so how do expectations align? Is it just a matter of sitting down and having a conversation saying, look, here's what we can do. Here's what you're responsible for.
Yes. I think it's important when both parties, as they're getting to know each other, it's understanding what is reasonable and what is unrealistic. And a distributor should be able to say to you, you know, this is what we will set out to do, and we will push as much as we can. But there's also a larger community in which we exist, and no distributor can guarantee almost anything.
Okay, so what would be an example of an unreasonable expectation from a filmmaker?
An Oscar.
Okay, fair enough, right?
So my response to that is always, we can qualify you. It will cost X amount. We're, you know, for some films, I just say no. For other films, I say we will qualify you, and then we'll take it from there. You know, all of us, of course, would love to walk down that red carpet, but nobody can guarantee that. That's probably the most common request and expectation that comes my way.
And if you qualify it, it means that Academy members will have the chance to vote on it potentially, but it might not get the nomination, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Just in closing up, I was going to have you compare the marketing approach for two or three of your recent films, Karl Marx's City, God Knows Where I Am, and the Maurizio Cattelan Be Right Back. Those are three films you've done recently. So I was hoping you could walk us through the way that you've catered the messaging, the awareness campaign for those different ones. Let's start with Karl Marx's City. As you mentioned, that was one dealing with a police state in Germany during the Cold War era. How did you go about creating a campaign for that?
Karl Marx's City premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival and then had its U.S. premiere at the New York Film Festival. Both of these are very prestigious venues, and the film came with critical praise. This allowed us to position the film as a definitive documentary that told a personal story. And we didn't focus so much with Karl Marx's City on grassroots outreach to people whose family members had committed suicide, because that really wasn't the focus of the film. We positioned that film as a festival and critics pick, and we were quite successful. It played for over a month at Film Forum and was on a split screen with I'm Not Your Negro for over 4 weeks. So that was a strategy that was appropriate. As it rolled out across the United States, we did reach out to the Goethe houses that were in the various cities where the film was playing to ask them to tell their communities who would be interested in German issues, German history. And that was effective. With God Knows Where I Am, this was a film that I acquired out of Hot Docs in 2016, where it had won the Special Grand Jury Prize. It's a film that both stands on its own as a cinematic experience. It won the award at the Seattle International Film Festival for the best cinematography. It's also a film, though, that addresses the issues of civil liberties, public health policy, and anybody who has a family or loved one who has suffered from mental illness. I've had many of my friends reach out to me and ask for links to watch the film because they have a son, daughter, mother, or husband who is bipolar. That was a film where we did bring on a grassroots activist, and we partnered with NAMI, which is the National Association advocating for mental health issues, And their chapters have also encouraged their members to see the film and to host screenings. So our strategy for God Knows Where I Am was both a traditional theatrical with the critics' praise, as well as grassroots to reach those audiences who are engaged with the issues that the film addresses. With Mauricio Catalan, this is an art film about the Italian artist and bad boy of the art world. We reached out to the Italian community here in New York City, and we're doing the same in Los Angeles, encouraging those people who are engaged in Italian culture to come and see the film. Mauricio Catalan is definitely a celebrity in Italy. We also have reached out to the art world. We have engaged with the Guggenheim and other art venues here in New York to encourage their members to come and see the film. And it's also because it's such a cultural event, we were lucky that the New Yorker gave us a shout out as well as in their magazine before the film opened at the Quad, encouraging people to go see the film. So on that one, the grassroots was mainly to the Italian community and to the art community, and then a fairly traditional publicity campaign focusing on the merits of the film.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're identifying the core aspects or core groups who would be compelled by the story and then doing special events and outreaches tailored to them.
Yes.
With a film like Karl Marx City, it strikes me that it could be of interest to both sides of the political spectrum. People on the right might be drawn to a story about oppression in a communist era regime. And then maybe people on the left might be drawn to a story about the excesses of a police state and how that affects contemporary society. Was it something you thought about? Did you all target people on both sides, or do you try to keep it apolitical?
The press that we generated from that film was very interesting because it was reviewed in numerous publications as a vehicle for discussing exactly this issue. When we sent out the initial press release with Susan Norgett, we did not overtly say that it was a film that argued either way. And therefore, when someone did review it, it revealed more about their personal interest than about the film.
Right. So that way, that's a good point. If you don't box something in initially, then the person can bring their own perspective, subjective interpretations. All right. For the trailer for Be Right Back, one of the things that was interesting to me about that was you all mentioned not just that he is an acclaimed artist and some people consider him a genius, but also that some people consider him one of the worst and that he's depraved by some. So were you all involved in that strategy?
Well, again, we put the movie out there. We put the trailer out there and we let the reviewers review the film. It was very funny because it opened Holy Weekend, so the Friday night before Easter Sunday. And it was reviewed by the Catholic press, who essentially said, we'll be in church and anybody who goes to see this film on, you know, over this weekend is clearly, they didn't quite say going to.
You're going to be excommunicated at the very least and your soul might be in
danger.
They'll
be praying for you. They were praying for you.
Right.
So again, that was a case where we put the film out there and depending on who his or her audience was, they would bring their interpretation to the film. It's always very interesting to watch that because I don't consider Mauricio Catalan a political film per se, but everything is political in these days and everyone has a very strong opinion. And I always like just to sit back and see what the reaction is. The more discussion, the better.
Right. But I mean, in the trailer that I saw, the trailer itself makes reference to some of his critics who call him depraved. So it's not just what the reviewers are seeing. The trailer is showing you both sides, right?
Right. He's an enfant terrible, and he really cultivates that part of his reputation.
So it sounds like you made a choice in the film marketing to say, well, this is a key part of who he is. Let's not hide it. Let's acknowledge that some people do really think he's depraved.
Yes.
Some people think he's a genius.
Yes. Well, you know, the same could be said about Mapplethorpe. So I suppose it has to do with part of the reason why he has such high stature also is because he's controversial.
The artist in the film does work that is considered shocking, as we suggested to some. Were you all also more inclined to use shock tactics in the promotion of the film?
Well, we actually had some lively discussions. We had several postcards that were under consideration. And one of his most famous images is the Pope being hit by a meteorite, which has become iconic. And I use that word here ironically. And so the postcards were printed. And I thought to myself, you know, if we had chosen a different image, we'd appeal to a wider audience rather than picking the most controversial of his images. And so I was presented with the image of the squirrel that committed suicide. I thought, you know, if the squirrel commits suicide, Pope gets hit by a meteorite, it is what it is. And so we printed both postcards, and the Catholics weren't going to like it one way or another, those who are more Orthodox. And so you have to run with the material you've got.
Did you get pushback from any animal lovers out there as well?
No, fortunately not.
Okay. And then going back to God Knows Where I Am, when you are dealing with a social issue and someone who has mental health issues, perhaps, and dealing with the family, What kind of sensitivity are you bringing to that, where you're trying to address that issue without exploiting the pain of the family members connected?
Linda Bishop's death was tragic. It was avoidable. I think that the film is incredibly sensitive to the subject matter that they are dealing with. At no point do they ever exploit her death for the ends of the filmmakers. I've worked very closely with the filmmakers, and certainly they were motivated by a desire to bring greater public awareness, a personal story, to an issue that all of us encounter every single day. And that is the issue of mental illness and homelessness in the United States. Most of the people who are homeless are not homeless by choice. They are homeless by a result of, you know, the fancy terminology would be impaired cognitive skills, but one, you know, mental illness for short. And if we don't make that connection as a society, the problem is not going to go away. It's not going to resolve itself. And this film seeks to make a larger audience aware of the consequences of our lack of policy or indifference.
Right. So it's almost like you're saying this happened, and perhaps here are things that can be done so that it doesn't keep happening to others.
Well, we need, I think the film at least wants to start that dialogue.
Yeah. And it sounds like you're trying to extend that dialogue with the marketing for that.
Yes. Yes, we are. And we're trying with our grassroots outreach to bring this film and to use it as a means to start that dialogue. And the greatest challenge with the marketing has been convincing editors that this film is a good vehicle to do so. It takes a cognitive leap to move from a documentary about one woman's death to a national discussion about healthcare policy. And unfortunately, some of the editors, you know, once you move out of the film being reviewed as a film and ask them to review it and discuss it as a vehicle to start that dialogue, it's interesting to see that many editors are reluctant to engage with it on that level.
Have there been some who have taken that leap?
There have been editorials, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, they have used the film and reviewed the film and connected that to policy issues, but not widely as we would like. Our objective was really to have a wide discussion in national publications with the film as a catalyst for that discussion. There are no experts in the film talking per se. It's not a film that's didactic. It's experiential. you watch the film and you can start to identify with Linda Bishop. And Linda Bishop, of course, is a mad woman. And that's an experience that I think is incredibly powerful. It's very rare in a documentary film. Most documentaries seek to educate, and they do that by telling you what to think. At no time in the film, and God knows where I am, does anybody ask you what to think. Because of the structure of the film, you identify with the protagonist, who's a dead woman.
Right. So it sounds like for some editors, that's a little more challenging than a piece where you have mental health experts expounding on the issue.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that is helpful to get a sense of some of the thinking behind those different films. So thanks for expanding on that. Last question for you here. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to this show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you?
I think mutual respect and good manners.
And do you want to give an example of what good manners is like?
Oh, it's probably easier to give a negative example in that case.
Okay.
Which I'll refrain from doing. It's a collaborative effort. Distributors can take your film and work with you and support it, but you know your film and you know your audience and you know the subject best. And so we need you to come on board as a partner. We will call you. We will email you. We will work with you. And we will answer your call when it comes our way and respond to your emails as well. And we really look to the filmmakers to point us in the right direction. Collaboration is really the key to a successful partnership at Bond.
All right. Well, people want to learn more about you or Bond. Where would they go?
Bond360films.com would be the place to start.
Okay, great. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives. It's great hearing more about the distribution side. And also hats off to you all because you help filmmakers make money, which is such a rare thing. And so
that's cool.
Thank you for that.
All right, Nick. Thank you.
You take care, Elizabeth.
All right, Nick. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. And that's my interview with Elizabeth Sheldon. That was quite helpful to me to think about and hear about how Elizabeth evaluates the films that come to her. I hope you found it helpful as well. And it is pretty interesting to learn about all the different ways they try to extend the conversation of a film. It's sort of like you put in all that time to make the film, whatever it is, and possibly you want to do more than just say, here it is. What do you think? That was fun. Let's move on. Sometimes you might want to say, let's continue this further. Again, you're putting in a sizable amount of your life trying to make it happen, maybe a few years. So why not think about ways to make that film resonate beyond just the theater experience? So seems like Elizabeth and her colleagues are working hard to help there. It was also notable to me the way that she was talking about how sometimes with filmmaking or your marketing to a film, you want to get out of the way a little bit and let the audience bring their own interpretation. You want to take a point of view, perhaps, but then also give some flexibility for people to discuss it. Even the films that we don't like sometimes add value to our lives. That's why we spend time discussing them in heated ways. But it's a chance to tell others, hey, this is what I'm about, and I'm definitely not about this. Just so you know. Oh, you are? Oh, okay, well, why do you see it that way? All right, so now I want to talk a little bit about God Knows Where I Am. Elizabeth was kind enough to share a screener with me so that I could get a better sense of the film, and it is quite powerful. As she suggested, it's beautifully shot. They have a lot of slow, steady cam-like shots or drone shots where they approach this empty house where Linda Bishop lived. And it's the kind of thing that could have been done terribly, where it's just a drawn out, slow motion, moving camera shot. A lot of bad ways to do that. Didn't happen here. It was very compelling, visually interesting. And that's saying a lot considering that a lot of the story takes place in an empty house. And we're hearing about the main events secondhand from interviews with others. So it works in that regard. Now, Linda Bishop is someone who is or was believed to have a mental illness, and she isolated herself in this empty house. People didn't really know she was there, and she was struggling to survive. Eventually, she starved to death. And so the film talks to some of her family members, some of her acquaintances, and also includes a reading of her journal. So you get inside of her head. As Elizabeth suggested, they're taking on this issue in a more or less first-person approach. You are getting other voices, but you're hearing a lot of the story through Linda's own words. So it does raise questions. For me, it wasn't so much about what should the state do for these kinds of situations. I guess there is some room for that discussion as well, but it's not the thing that was of primary interest to me. I was intrigued at how she became so isolated from people. And even some of her family said that she was difficult to get along with. They kept a distance from her. So it made me wonder, was she keeping her distance from others because she was mentally ill? Or did keeping distance from others make her become mentally ill? I do believe we are meant to live in community. And we've talked about that on this show. Aristotle and the ancient Greeks understood people to be defined by their relation to the community. So it was something like, well, what is a person? A person is someone who lives within a polis or a little city community. That was key to their understanding of what a person is. And they built entire philosophies around that. So someone who is not involved in the city, in a community, it's almost like there's something that's not fully human about that person. And we see them and we wonder, what happened? How did this person become that way? We start off our lives surrounded by people, mom and dad and family and friends, and then some of us retreat from the world. And it comes up when you're working on a film project or artwork, writing, you're spending time in isolation from others, but then you're usually trying to get back to them. It's not just, let me write this thing and never show it to anyone. It's let me write this thing, create this thing, and then I will come back and share it with others. But then there are some of us who move away from community for various reasons. Maybe it's our own hurts, things we face in the past, the discouragements, or maybe our own shortcomings, maybe our anger or our desire to dominate. Those things might get in the way. So, well, I must be the king here. I can't live in harmony with others. And then that eats away at the social fabric, that harmony between people, which raises another interesting point. The film title is based on something that Linda wrote in her journal. God knows where I am, she was writing. She's out here in this abandoned house. No one else is really reaching out to her, but God knows where she is, suggesting that of itself will be enough. And the film provides the counterpoint. It didn't work out in her case. So, was she foolish for relying solely on God? Is that making some kind of statement against faith? Or is it more involved than that? I wouldn't say that the film is necessarily anti-faith, but it does seem to suggest that maybe more should have been done than just relying on God. And that does pose a challenge when we try to talk about God. Now, I mentioned on the show that I am a person of faith, conflicted, but it's still something I come back to. It's still something I wrestle with on a daily basis. But there is that sense, how could a loving God allow such horrible things to happen to people? And there are instances throughout history where people have trusted in God only to end up starving in isolation or something comparable, getting disease, facing genocide, slavery, and the like. Why doesn't God show up in those cases? Or does he? Is it just that we can't see the way that he's working? I mean, the tricky thing is we don't know what is actually going on inside of people's heads and hearts. Those little promptings that we get, that sense, maybe you should not go to this place or that. No, I'm going. And then it ends up going badly, ends up costing a lot of money. Well, you had that sense not to go. You ignored it. Now, was that sense just some rational thought? Hey, don't go here. You're going to spend money. Possibly. But are there ever instances when it goes beyond that? I've had instances like that where it felt like that was the case. I mean, I would have a sense that I should talk to a friend. I haven't talked to that person for a while. And so I say, all right, why not? That's not a bad thing to do. It's not like I'm getting a sense that I should give all of my money to some tele-evangelist. I'd be a little more wary of that. But all right, let me talk to a friend. Yeah, why not? And then I discover that friend had been robbed just a day or two ago. I had no way of knowing that. I hadn't been in touch with her for several days. So there are instances like that. I have a couple more. Maybe you have situations like that as well. And so we don't know. We don't know. Were people involved getting a sense that they should go and act? Was she getting a sense that she should go and do things differently? And she ignored it out of bitterness or pride or anger or whatever. I don't know. There was clearly some tension between her and her family. Family members themselves admitted that they didn't like being around her sometimes, which was a brave thing for them to say in this documentary about her death. Well, sometimes she wasn't the easiest to be around. I wonder why. So who knows? Who knows what might have happened if people had done things differently? We don't know. We can't go back and test those things. And so even people who do look for the hand of God or providence throughout history acknowledge that it's not just God. I mean, there are consequences for actions. There's the notion of free will. And there's also the notion of the possibly all-knowing, all-powerful God. And so potentially such a God would be able to anticipate all likely outcomes and various possibilities, like an infinite universe. The quantum theories out there sometimes are not all that different. So you have someone who can possibly make those perceptions in ways that we can't understand. We are confined to experiences in these confined dimensions. We don't have this big picture view of the entire cosmos or space and time. So our perceptions are limited. But throughout history, even people of faith have acknowledged that they need to take action for themselves. And it's possible that God is acting through others, right? That he wants us to step up and do what needs to be done. That little prompting, hey, maybe you should stick up for this guy. Maybe you should donate some time to charity. It could be just the rational thought of someone, or it could be something else. If we do allow the possibility of a God, that such a God seems to be interested in developing others of a certain character. There's evil, but then there's also the chance to oppose it and act in considerate ways that go beyond just doing the egotistical thing, right? Like, oh yeah, I'm pretty awesome. Pretty awesome. I've got my name everywhere. And this is it. Maybe there's more to it. I will tell you, though, this is something I wrestle with. It's not an easy thing to think about. And I can understand how someone might say, look, Linda Bishop, she trusted in her own limited way that God was looking out for her. And yet, she starved to death. What are we to make of that? She even has that religious sounding name, Linda Bishop, someone connected to the church. And yet, even she starves. And the film uses the apples as a visual motif. It was what she was living on when she was in that abandoned house. So they were there, but they also use it as a kind of style thing. Maybe going back to the whole Adam and Eve story. I'm not sure, but it's there. And so for me personally, it's something I struggle with. I'm not an entirely faith-based guy. I don't make all of my decisions about that. I mean, I work for canon that involves some understanding of physics. When I go on camera shoots, I don't think, well, let me just pray and this will get resolved. I say, well, maybe I should learn a little bit about how this camera works, the lights involved. Let's see if we can plan the schedule to give us time to set up and all these things. So it's not like I am relying on one sphere exclusively over another. It's just they're both things I think about, faith and science. It's worth noting that's not something new. Faith and science went hand in hand for quite a while. Thomas Aquinas, the preeminent medieval theologian, was also one of the leading men of science of his time. See that with some others as well, like Isaac Newton also had developed thoughts on God and so on. Now, in our disjointed time, they're kept apart. There's that long history of distrust of the two communities for good reason, but it doesn't have to be an either or kind of thing. Now, I'll tell you, I have tried in the past to listen to those little quiet prompts, those big picture things. It feels like this is something I'm supposed to do. And I would even wrestle with those senses. No, that can't be right. I don't think so. I'm imagining, wishful thinking. And I'd get a whole lot of things, little coincidences or serendipitous moments, hearing from just the right person, running into a stranger who was in some way connected, seeing a film or reading a book that related exactly to what I was wrestling with at the time, and so on. So I listened. I tried to seek a sense of higher purpose of listening to that little prompt, that little whisper. It says, you should do this and not this. Because there's a bigger thing going on. It might not make sense right now, but try to trust. Try to just take one step forward. Okay. Now, I'm a conflicted guy. I don't always get it right. That's not to suggest I'm saintly. I think if you listen to the show for any amount of time, you will quickly get that sense. So I might be one of those things where I take one step forward, two steps back, and then I get tangled up and out of step because I'm getting in the way. That's possible. But then for a long time, I did listen the best I could, and it got me here. It brought me to this strange place where I don't know what is next. I don't really see how things will work. I don't understand how any of these things relate to the big picture plan, the things that are so meaningful to me in the deepest part of my heart. So those things seem further away than maybe ever. I don't know. Or maybe it's just my perception, how I'm feeling after I've been discouraged. It's interesting. I mentioned Trent's War earlier in the episode, the short film I shot about a soldier battling PTSD. And I mentioned it in other episodes too. For a while, it was a big part of my life. It did take a big leap of faith for me to work on it, to continue to work on it in the ways that I have, in spite of the numerous obstacles and rejections we faced. And not only that, it also brought some personal discouragements. And it seems like that tends to happen to me. I listen, I try to trust, and I'm left in this unsettling place. Maybe I was wrong in trusting. Maybe it was all just wishful thinking and a whole lot of notable coincidences. Those of you who listen to the show know that the number 23 comes up a couple of times from one episode to the next. This time, it came up in God Knows Where I Am. It was the only full-length film from Bond 360 that I had the opportunity to see, and it came after the interview, not before. I didn't see it and say, oh, it's got 23, I'm going to do this interview. It happened afterwards. Elizabeth provided it to me after we did the interview. But it was there once again, and it was there right in the same part of the film where Linda was writing in her journal. We hear her voice, and then the title comes up, God Knows Where I Am, written in context to Psalms 23. It was right there in the discussion. So it's not just like the number showed up on a random license plate. It was right there, right at the heart of the film and its title. Also, a little unsettling. You know, the number keeps showing up in these odd ways, but I still am not sure if it's a good or bad number. It's just one that keeps coming up for whatever reason. It might be that some unfortunate accident will befall me someday, and then I'll turn and see that it's the number on the license plate of the truck that's going to run me over. So I don't know, but it is there. So a little dissonance seeing it there made me question things. Am I wrong? Is so much of what I believed for so long so wrong? Who knows? Possibly. It also showed up in regards to The Imposter, one of the films that Bond 360 worked on. That film was released on January 23rd, 2012 at Sundance. So again, not an encouraging appearance for a film about a con man. Now, it did also come up in one other instance that sort of relates to this discussion. Last episode, I was talking to a couple of people. One of them was Andrew Vogel, an actor and one of the people who works for Louisiana International Film Festival. And incidentally, he was also the actor in Trent War. In that interview, he mentioned a producer who has become a kind of mentor to him, Dawn Krantz. She's one of the producers on Man Down. And that was a reminder that Man Down was a film on my list to see. Hadn't gotten to it yet. And so looked, it was on Netflix, got it in my queue. And I watched it and was taken by the number of similarities it has to our short Trent's War. It also deals with a soldier battling PTSD. And both films try to look at PTSD from a subjective view. What does it look like to experience that? How does it feel for someone caught up in the midst of it? And that film mentions the number 23. It's in the audio commentary, but then the number 17 is in that film as well. That's the not 23 number that I look for to see if it's just random. Like, keep seeing number 23, but maybe also I'm looking for a confirmation bias. All right, so 17 has a an ominous note for me in recent history. So I'm like, all right, I'll look for that. I haven't seen it mostly in these recent episodes, except in Man Down. It's there as well as the 23rd. The 23rd comes up when they're talking about the shooting days. That's how many days they shot for, 23 days, they mentioned in the audio commentary. And I noted, too, that they had a military advisor who was part of the commentary named Nick. So anyway, these things came up as I was wrestling with whether I really wanted to share Trent's War publicly. It was that night. And I was apprehensive. There's going to be a chance that we'll just get some nice, polite comments from people on Facebook, like, oh, good job. Here's your participation trophy or whatever. And then it would trickle out. And how I was going to share it, what I was going to say about it, something that was so conflicting to me. Probably some of the people whose opinions most matter to me, who were even involved in the film in some way, they're probably going to remain quiet about it. So all those things are going through my mind, and I see Man Down, and it just resonates so much. And that wasn't the only thing. There were two other instances that day. One, a friend of mine tagged me in something about a military wife sharing a story about her husband battling PTSD. We haven't talked about that for days. I haven't shared anything on the Trent's War page for over a year and a half, maybe 2 years. She said, hey, check this out. You should maybe include this on your page. So it was that and one or two other things that happened that day when I was thinking about it. So once again, these little serendipities were there. This little prompting, there's a bigger picture here. There's a reason for this. Try to trust. Well, I trusted and I got here, and it was terrible. How could this lead to anything more than just, all right, well, that was an experience. Moving on to the next one. So I don't know. I'm still conflicted. It might just be that it's all a mistake, that I'm foolish in some way for trusting these things, for continuing to trust when it seemingly hasn't worked out. I'm in this place where I don't understand what comes next, and it's brought a lot of heartache to me. And yet, there's still that little tugging that says, no, try, look closer. Maybe the things that really matter to you aren't as far away as you think. You just have to follow through, stay the course, and all that jazz. Well, anyway, it gives you something to think about, right? Something to discuss, and that's what great works of film and art and literature can do. And certainly, God Knows Where I Am is worth seeing. I would call it a cinematic achievement. Even if perhaps I draw different conclusions than the filmmakers, and I'm not even sure I do, because they present it in a very even-handed way, allowing us to make our own interpretation. So there's that. It is worth seeing. And to put a cap on it, that's what a distributor like Bond 360 can do. It can allow these films to get seen in a broader way. I enjoy these blockbuster films like the next person, but our lives are richer when we have more than just the next Marvel film, End of the World franchise.
The last time we told you the world was about to end in a catastrophic way, it didn't. But this time it really, really might. Come see it. Bigger, better, louder than ever this summer.
What's going to happen this time? I don't know. I'm going to buy this ticket. Anyway, there's value in seeing some of these other films as well that help us reflect on our lives in all kinds of ways. So thank you to Bond 360 and companies like them for helping that to happen. Thank you to Elizabeth for coming and talking to us. If you care about those kinds of films, try to see them in the theaters or rent them as they come out right away, if you can. It is one of those little things that gives them the boost they need, little nudges step by step to keep it going so they can continue to make it viable to compete against these bigger films. Okay, so keep that in mind. Well, that's our show. Once again, we covered all kinds of things. What are your thoughts? How do you think about things on the film marketing side? Or do you want to get into some of the big picture discussions? Why are we here? Why are you listening to this podcast? I don't know. But either way, you can leave a comment or shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. Music for the show, beginning and the end here, provided by Rob Coslow. It's the song True Gemini. If you like the show, would you consider sharing it with a friend, someone who might gain value from it? And then you all could have related conversations. Maybe that could be a chance for you to get your project off the ground. So it could help me, but it could also help you. So think it over, all right? And then remember, too, if you want to see Trent's War or some of the other things I've worked on, look for the videos heading on the podcast site. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.
This time, the aliens are bringing company. Zombies, bats, and clowns.